terribly odd that the actual mechanism should be relatively similar. The power transmission in Italy was quite different, with these huge open lanterns.
Yeah.
They didn't have in China. Yeah. But the actual, the twiddly bits are not enormously dissimilar. In China, it in fact operated both in silk, which is where it originally began, the twisting silk. You know, when you draw the fibres off the cocoon in a vat of boiling water, yeah, you have to, in fact, well, first you lay them down in thin bands, then to get strength you have to twine them together, and better still cross twine them again back afterwards. But it also applied to hemp fibres, which are longer and tougher than cotton. And what's interesting here, this is from 1313, you can actually see a picture. That has to go with that. That's part of the same wheel. This is just the problem of reproduction. If you want to see how it probably worked, I did a reconstruction there, how that may have worked. There is an alternative reconstruction which would also work, though it doesn't fit the picture as well.
Hmm.
So
it's pretty good going from that to that. Well,
that's just a sideways view of what was probably going for one of these units.
Oh, I see.
It needs a little bit of thought to see how it might have worked. This was vetted, the question about this thing existing. The actual reconstruction at the most critical moment is a guess. And the two alternative reconstructions, one done by the Needham group, with whom I'm very friendly, and one done 17 years earlier by me, both depend ultimately on making it up plausibly to fit the picture and a defective text. In other words, we don't actually know. And I would love to have another go at it with maybe somebody like Jerry with engineering expertise, you know, to see if we can get any further. No promises, but that would be an interesting prospect. The critical thing about this is that it died. It's looking at an extinct species. By the 15th century, it's all there. And in fact, it's quite clear from the garbling of later drawings, which were copies of copies of copies, that the artists had never seen it, and the text indicated, unless there were straight quotes, that nobody knew what had happened. So here you've got a fascinating problem. All the basic elements of mechanized industry are there. You take the movement of a hand, you make a mechanical replica, you then multiply it up, you know, then work the whole lot by inanimate power. What is left to solve, except to make it economically viable?
And that's...
How many were linked up at a time?
About 30-odd.
How do you know that?
Because it says so. There's a text that goes with it.
Okay.
In fact, I mean, the text is translated in this article. This is... one that you've got copies of, haven't you?
Yes.
For later work. So you could make off with that and Alan can make me another copy of my own work, which I don't have with me.
Now, having read this, which I think Mark's analysis is fascinating, and I think it is correct. I've got no arguments with it as an engineer at all. But there's something that puzzled me greatly, and that's why I brought up this collection of drawings. If we move the chair away and we'll have a look at them, we'll see where my puzzlement lies. The problem is to try to understand why this mechanized industry ran into stasis and why it subsequently declined the way they all went. And it's something to do with the societies. The societies in which this technology arose, was used, and declined. Now, if we look at a number of pictorial representations, the iconography of European innovations over a period of about 250 years. This is rapid stuff. This is rapid change, you see. This represents modernity and coming up to what is...
So this is how, this is 250 years along...
Yeah, look, this one, I'm starting here with Agricola, 1530,
right,
who is writing up German, the Herz Mountain,
mining. Mm-hmm. And it's not the earliest one. The earliest one is...
Well, this is probably a much later, sophisticated version
of
the Lucerna, which they had in Bologna and in Lucca.
Yeah.
That is not 13th century, but it is a descendant of that.
Yes.
Much more beautifully articulated, but it's
that
is probably the oldest in terms of underlying conception.
Yes.
What I'm
suggesting we try to do, and why I was very pleased to get together with Mark on it, because he's the expert on the Chinese culture and Chinese machinery, and I'm not at all, is to try and look at these drawings, not try and work out with what the machines are, but try to work out what the person who produced the drawing was producing it for, what he's trying to convey, and what that might tell us about the society in which he and his audience are living.
Wondering to the extent to which the centralised, more top-down system of distribution of technology might have been responsible for its constraint in China. There was a free enterprise as well, mixed in, wasn't there?
The system by, say, 1600 or 1700, which I guess the dates of reference, is fundamentally best described as a free market system. They then got to put the qualifications in, but it is fundamentally a system of markets exploding in number and density on the map. And there's no reason to stop people in most cases from transporting technology around. There are two factors here. I mean, certainly top down may have some problems, it also has some virtues. You can send official from province A, not just to provinces next door, but all across the empire. Mm-hmm. There's a scale of movement, which particularly actually in the earlier Song dynasty is demonstrably beneficial. By later times it doesn't seem to do very much, but there is that. In some areas, particularly water control, the government even timorously, but not totally vacuously, really encourages people to find new ways of solving difficult hydraulic problems.
Mm.
But it curiously doesn't do this in the copper mines, where there are tremendous problems of drainage and ventilation, and the copper currency got more and more difficult, more expensive to produce because of this. So I've never been able to work out why officials could find a new way of dealing with the Yellow River or some particular specific problem, to be more precise, were looked on basically.
Well,
it's a very complicated mixture.
Complicated mix there, yes. And this is why I was wondering whether the form of the drawings gave any clue to what was going on. Because these drawings in this European tradition are essential to, initially to the transfer, to the increased interest in technology, then to the transfer of technology. In their absence, you have to get hold of one of the artifacts and examine it, take it to pieces, understand how it works. This seemed to me to be essential, quite essential, to industrial infrastructure in which you have subcontractors supplying a central machine builder. You have to have a precise method of specifying what you want, so that it is unarguable on both sides of whether you got it. It seems to me to be essential to have an education system which is teaching the detail. If you're thrown back on local, in effect, in industry, increasing precision in the artifact, the industrial infrastructure of suppliers of parts in order to make a complex whole, on
on how to assemble and how to keep the thing going. With an open thing that gets more complex, a major problem is keeping it going. I don't know if you remember pictures of Saudi Arabia after the initial oil boom in 74. I've been there, I'm amazed to see these things. We get a huge caterpillar planes, mile after mile of them along the roadside, laid up, rusting, dead. They're dead. Because there is no mechanism, even in that society, of repairing them when even the slightest thing goes wrong.
The exact opposite in China. I must come to Shanghai. So this is where all of these things are put to a high precision test.
What date are you talking about?
Talking about 1850 onwards. Yeah. 1850. The two great British shipyards, Farnham's and Boyd's, yeah, were the training ground, basically, of the modern Chinese engineer.
Yeah.
The government arsenal was the third, good but less good, with foreign supervisors. People who'd had 5 to 10 years here normally left, set up their engineering firms. I've written an article on this, I give you every darn detail. And they then would do a mixture of things. They would do repairs on their own. They would do subcontracting work, sometimes, I think, with blueprints, but often, I suspect, not. Hard to be sure about that. They would begin to make simple imitations. They were very good at imitating Italian silk villages by the 1870s at a fraction of the price. They then began to wander around looking at Western factories, after there were Western factories in some number, and copying, imitating, subcontracting. It was a complete flow, and because Shanghai was an international port, difficult skills could be bought somewhere. You could find a foreigner or somebody else to do it. Skilled labourers could be enticed, and the difficult bits, and they were very important, the one difficult bit you couldn't make, you could buy from overseas. Now the thing that I'm going to say, just very briefly, is that by 1930, they were not only able to make, but had independent design every form of textile machinery necessary for the complete production of cotton textiles. You have here a complete continuum. Now, I just don't know how much drawings were used in this. My impression is that they still used artisan methods to an extraordinary degree. But the one thing they could do was to make old rotten machinery thrown out by Western factories live again. Yeah. They're the exact opposite of the Saudis.
They're wonderful.
They're wonderful. Yes, I've seen just them. Bloody wonderful.
Yes. Well, now, if we take one of the more complex of these twisting machines, silk twisting machines, suppose it is developed in the north somewhere. What is the mechanism for it getting 1,000 miles away? Reproduced 1,000 miles away.
Chap moves, or occasionally at official orders, is moved.
That's the mechanism.
A tiny, tiny handful of exceptions here and there. For example, the so-called wooden dragon, a kind of floating revetment, if you like, for dikes. It could be floated down and then lashed into place, which was revived after the Sung text. One or two other things like that. But very broadly speaking, these are the rarest. I found about three of them. I'm trying to remember what the other two were. One was to do with some kind of ultra-deep line, which were taken from books by keen officials. But basically, you moved chaps. I suppose it could be chapesses too, but mostly it was chaps.
Right. Now, was there anything equivalent to intellectual property rights? See, the latter end of this series are patents, that somebody has a monopoly of what they have defined for a certain period of time for commercial purposes. Any other purposes?
Well, the only examples which almost in effect prove the opposite case, sorry, they support your case, I mean there are some cases, are where a family kept its own family secret. This is known to have happened in certain kinds of spinning machinery, that one family, which says the book, it wouldn't even tell their sons-in-law, only their sons. Certain kinds of riveting techniques to put very valuable old porcelain together again so that it looked as good as new, or better even. Yes. A certain cachet and
the Coca-Cola technique.
Yeah, if you like. Secret recipe. Exactly, not the secret recipe. And there are, of course, stories where the son died prematurely, and the technique was lost. Yeah. But that's the only clear example. Spinning machinery.
For instance, had been produced. This was water powered weaving. Had been produced in Danzig, Frankfurt, in Leiden. In every case, local weavers got it suppressed. In the case I know about in Leiden, it filtered out a little, but already very quiet if you had one, that increased your productivity over the others. It was a family thing and kept it locked away. Just the same thing happened in England when new spinning machinery or weaving machinery came out. The first power loom weaving mill of Cartwright was burned down to the ground, Arkwright, with his water frame, very, very strong reaction, but the innovations survived. So the suppression was unsuccessful. The attempts by people in the trade suppress. My suppression was unsuccessful. That's why I used the term this morning, that the Industrial Revolution occurred in England first, because the English were less successful in suppressing it than the continental
countries. A merciful inefficiency,
yes. Yes. Lots of people would have thought it was a horrendous inefficiency to produce this tremendous social disruption of increasing the productivity of one individual 10 times. But it was a merciful inefficiency, and cumulatively it led to the escape of new technologies, which then escaped back to the places that had previously banned them. Because if a new weaving technique which reduced costs has been developed in one society and has been developed but banned in an adjoining society, so that the innovating society can now sell to the banning society at a much lower cost, and which is quite quickly the result. That's the reason for the then all the arguments about suppressing it and the means of suppressing it have disappeared.
So it's in the guild members' interest.
And they swap over very quickly. Yeah. Very quickly indeed. And that's what you see that time and time again.
What was the time lag between when they suppressed it and when they took it up in places like Leiden, wherever they suppressed it?
Suppressing it and taking it up.
Well between
the deciders. And how to twist them together and make a lock in and it's a tremendous detail. Mm. You don't get the detail right, you forget the machine, all the rest of it is just rubbish. So, but within a decade of these things happening in England, they would be copied either with spies or with craftsmen given good wages. Most amusing things happen, really. Hilarious. Henry VIII brought over ironworkers to Sussex. This is